This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Coming up next, conversations on human rights with Speak Up, Kōrero Tia, here on Plains FM.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā. Tēnā koutou katoa. No mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak Up, Kōrero Tia. Tune in as our guests Speak Up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right.
No mai haere mai. Welcome to Speak Up Kōrero Tia. I'm your host Sally Carlton, based here in Christchurch. Today's topic is the COP process, that's the Conference of Parties, an effective means to combat climate change? Bit of a mouthful, but I'm sure we'll break it down bit by bit. We've got three guests here today, two in the studio in Christchurch, and Hamish, thank you for joining us via Skype from London. That's pretty cool.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Hamish, maybe we'll kick it off with you. What's your relation to climate change and the COP process particularly?
I think I first got interested in sort of climate change and the climate justice movement when I attended the PowerShift conference in Auckland in 2012. And since then, I've been involved with Generation Zero, the youth climate change group in New Zealand. And since then, I've also completed a master's in sustainable energy in here in London. And I attended the COP21 negotiations in Paris last year.
What was that conference that you first mentioned, the one in 2012?
PowerShift.
Could you maybe just tell us a little bit about it?
It was a conference organised by Generation Zero and 350.org to sort of inspire the youth of today to take action action on climate change.
It's interesting you say that, actually, because I was just mentioning to these guys that this is perhaps the youngest panel of guests I think Speak Up's ever had. yeah, which I think says something probably about the people who are most concerned or most active anyway in the climate change space.
Yeah, absolutely, definitely.
And how about you guys?
So I'm also actually part of Generation Zero now. I came on board just after that conference in 2013, 2014. We had a movement called Climate Voter, which was done in New Zealand, where we encouraged people to vote with the climate as the top of the list, as a priority. And that was done in collaboration with people like Oxfam and WWF and Greenpeace and stuff. So that's where I kind of got involved in Generation Zero. But my training is as a physicist, so I've always been interested in climate change and how, you know, whether what we're doing in the political process actually reflects what we need to do with the science. And locally with Generation Zero, at the moment we're saying, you know, it's not enough. So we're actually drafting some legislation that we're going to be presenting to government next March, hopefully, saying, look, we need to be a lot more ambitious than what we are at the moment. So that's kind of the interest. And so the question of whether COP is effective at dealing with climate change is kind of paramount, because it filters down and affects what every government in the world does. So that's where my interest is for that.
Fantastic. And maybe just if you could introduce yourself.
Oh, sorry. yes, so my name is Phubudu Senanayake. Like I said, I trained as a physicist. At the moment, I work as an analyst for the government. But I'm not here in that role today, obviously. And I'm, I guess, a bit of an activist in the climate scene, involved with Generation Zero mostly, but also helping out with stuff that things like 350.org and 350 Christchurch do, involved in local politics in so much that we want to encourage more people to vote and get involved and trying to make that process easier. So that's kind of our... Yeah.
And on that note, Phubudu, we've just had the local body elections, and I know that Generation Zero were very active in promoting this idea of voting for candidates' climate policies. Maybe if you could just mention some stuff about that would be great.
Cool. So what we did was we sent out, essentially surveyed candidates who were standing for local elections at the council level and at the mayoral level and in some regions at the regional council level. And we asked them different questions about where they stood on climate change, what they thought were viable solutions. So for Generation Zero, we think that cities are a main point of focus. So things like public transport, alternative modes of transport, better urban design will help us reduce our emissions, which is the ultimate goal of any climate action. So we asked them questions about their priorities with regards to those aspects of governance in a local sense. And then we scored them depending on how they did and how they answered. And we produced scorecards so that people could actually see, you know, if you care about these issues, who's your best candidate? And yeah, it was quite effective. We got quite a lot of traffic on a website that we made, and we think we've had an impact. Of course, it's hard to measure exactly how many votes went for a certain person. But one of the main things is that we are a nonpartisan organization. So we don't actually care who gets elected as long as they do the job. So because of that, you know, we didn't say you should vote for this person. What we said was, here's how they align on these issues. You can make a choice now.
Very cool. And Jeff?
Yeah, I'm Jeff Willis. I kind of got involved with climate change activism and things towards the end of my undergraduate degree, which I did in the United States. I think I wish there was sort of one kind of seminal moment. People ask me that a lot, that I could be like, it was that made me realize. But there was no kind of one thing. I think I just kind of, I got increasingly frustrated with the political discourse in the United States about climate change, which really didn't seem to align with the science at all. And then I came to New Zealand to do postgrad work because I wanted to do some work in the Pacific. And now I'm doing a political science PhD here in Christchurch, the University of Canterbury, on a topic related to climate change issues in the Pacific. And my relation to COP, last year I was the social media director for an international NGO called Pull to Paris. And I attended COP21 as part of that. And since then, I also associate produced a climate change documentary on climate change issues in Bangladesh. So that's kind of my background with it.
And what's the documentary called?
It's called 30 Million, and it's available free online. Shameless plug.
And it's all about, it. Do it. Now, I guess the first question is, what is COP?
So COP really... it's just a meeting. That's basically all it is, conference of parties. It's a meeting of countries that have signed up to the UNFCCC, which is the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. So when we say COP, really all we're saying is a meeting. It's just, like I said, a gathering of countries that have signed up to this sort of overarching climate change framework.
And then the second question following on from that, we're talking climate change here. I don't think it's disputed much anymore, but you'll have to fill me in on that.
I mean, it's maybe you want to take this with the science part, and then I'll...
Right. So you mean kind of an introduction to what climate change actually is.
Mm.
Okay, so basically, climate change broadly refers to the phenomenon by which the Earth is warming up, not due to anything natural. And the reason for that, or at least in this context, and the reason for that is that as we put out greenhouse gases, which are things like carbon dioxide, methane, and other things, you get this effect where sunlight coming in heats up the surface of the Earth, and as the surface of the Earth heats up, it emits radiation again, so emits light at a different wavelength. And the atmosphere of the Earth and the greenhouse gases that it contains absorbs that radiation and then re-emits it and warms the atmosphere up. And so that's why the Earth is actually at a livable temperature naturally, because otherwise we would have like negative 20 degrees or something, it'd be way too cold. But what we've done is we've put out so much greenhouse gases, so carbon dioxide and all these other things, that we are starting to go beyond what is actually manageable for the Earth's atmosphere. So it's heating up too much. And what you're doing is you're putting in way too much energy into the atmosphere. And so you're causing all sorts of disruptions in weather patterns and, you know, kind of the sea currents. And what that does in turn is basically make the Earth less and less and less livable for us and other species. So basically, in a nutshell, we're putting out these greenhouse gases. It's trapping more heat in from the sun on the surface of the Earth and in the upper atmosphere. It's warming it up too much, and it's causing untold disruption.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I'd add to that really is I think we'd all agree within sort of the scientific community, it's not really disputed. I mean, there's disputes and disagreements about what the impacts will be, how severe they'll be, things like that. But in terms of whether or not climate change is happening and is primarily driven by man-made, that's not that disputed. But in political discourse, that's a different thing, particularly in places like the U.S. But I'm sure we'll get into that at some point.
And I think one of the other things to really point out is in this kind of scientific context, the dispute about impacts is it going to be bad or is it going to be really, really, really bad? Yeah. So it's not, that's not good in that. So that's also kind of important to keep in mind.
Have you got anything you want to add, Hamish?
No, I guess I just sort of, you know, repeat what's being said. From the COP perspective, it seemed like the debate has been settled there. None of the countries are really debating about whether or not climate change is happening, but the discussion is more centered around how do we deal with this issue.
Yeah, so the focus is on the response now.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, well, with that in mind, just really quickly before we go into our first break, what are some of the responses that are taking place?
Do you mean sort of within the COP context? Or
not necessarily.
Just...
I think we'll get into that later, but you've mentioned, for example, carbon budget.
Oh, yeah. Do you want to take a little carbon budget?
So the carbon budget is a kind of a broad term that defines how much carbon dioxide or greenhouse gases we can put into the atmosphere before we reach dangerous levels of temperature rise. And we've defined that as 2 degrees Celsius. It's the kind of the upper level we want to be at. And the current carbon budget, it's kind of a strange concept because what it is if we hit the current carbon budget for 2 degrees warming, what that means is we have a 2/3 chance of staying below 2 degrees warming if we cut off our greenhouse gas emissions at that level. So it's actually a probability thing. It's not a certainty. And in most things, 2/3 probability isn't a good number, right? If I told you, get on a plane, there's a 2/3 chance you won't crash. You'd be like, I don't think I want to go on that plane. But when we're dealing with the world, we're like, 2/3, it's fine. But anyway, so some of the initiatives that are taking place are people are saying, okay, well, we need to cap it at this level. So economists are trying to shift away from fossil fuels and carbon emitting processes for generating energy. But it's a hard process because it's been embedded in our lives for, 100 years plus. So there is a great shift, for example, in China, from away from coal towards renewable energy sources for the energy production. That's happening a lot in Germany. I mean, there's been a massive shift there. Countries like some Scandinavian countries are already producing more energy from renewable sources on some days than they need. So the main focus has been for countries, I think, is to get is towards generating energy without using fossil fuels. There are other things like tree plantations, which happens in New Zealand a lot, or happened in New Zealand a lot. So there are technological solutions that are coming to the fore. In terms of legislation, there's things like the United Kingdom Climate Change Act, which actually sets limits and legally binding limits on how the UK has to track its climate change carbon budgets every 5 years to make sure it meets targets that it says it wants to meet. And so it's that kind of thing hasn't really spread around the world too much, but we're hoping that it will.
Okay, well, that seems like a good place to have our first break, and then we're going to get more into the COP process itself. Hamish, we've got your song, Idiotech by Radiohead. What was the reason for this choice?
I guess this song's been known for a while as an environmental anthem, so I thought it was appropriate to play at this point.
I'm
Nā mai hoki mai, welcome back to Speak Up Kōrero Tia, here on Plains FM 96.9. Iwi Sally Carlton, your host, Pupuru Saniyaki, Hamish Lang, coming in from Skype from London, and Jeff Willis. And we're thinking about the COP process and is it an effective means of combating climate change? This part we're going to be looking specifically at what is COP and how did it get off the ground, I suppose. So to start the discussion then, what is it and when did it start?
So to understand sort of the COP process, like I said in the first segment, COPs are really just meetings. And they sort of fall under this broader framework, the UNFCCC, which is the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And that was negotiated at the Earth Summit in Rio in the early 90s, in 92, and it entered into force in 94. And it has a quite broad goal of stabilizing greenhouse gas concentrations below a level that would prevent dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system. That's the terminology that they use. And the UNFCCC doesn't really do anything by itself except sort of set up this framework whereby the COP meetings can happen and different protocols and things can come in, like the Paris Agreement, which we'll talk about later. So that's really where the process starts, early 90s at the Earth Summit, when climate change was really first becoming a serious political issue. The first COP was in Berlin in 1995, but probably the most significant one. Well, there's really three kind of quite significant COPs that have happened in the history of the COP process. One, COP3 in Kyoto, which produced the Kyoto Protocol, which probably most people will have heard of. COP15 in Copenhagen in 2009, which is famous for being a disaster and basically completely falling apart. And then COP21 in Paris last year, which produced the Paris Climate Agreement. So, yeah, that's the process. If you guys want to jump in with anything before we move on.
Yeah, so I think one thing to add to that is that it is a conference of parties of the world. So, you know, pretty much everyone from someone from every country in the world will be there, if not more people than one person. But so you can understand why it's the arduous process and why it has the potential to fall apart, because you know, getting one country's political parties to agree on something is hard enough. But when you have, you know, completely different economies, completely different political philosophies coming together trying to sort something out, so you take something like China and the United States or even India, you know, it's hard to see eye to eye sometimes. And I think that's one of the reasons that things can fall apart really quickly. And that's kind of what happened in Copenhagen.
Yeah. And it's one of the reasons that the Kyoto Protocol was not as successful as it could have been.
Do you want to explain why it wasn't so successful?
Well, different reasons in different places, but like you were saying, I mean, one of the things, sort of the design of the Kyoto Protocol was that it split up developing and developed nations quite severely. And a lot of the developed countries, and particularly the U.S., a lot of these things will come back to the U.S., but particularly the U.S., the U.S. was never very happy that some of the developing, what were called developing countries like China and India, didn't really have to reduce their emissions as much as the developed countries did, and they thought that was fundamentally unfair. So when that treaty, or when the Kyoto Protocol was passed, Bill Clinton, who was president at the time, signed it, and the Senate at the time unanimously said, we're not going to pass this. So it never even got submitted to the Congress to be passed as a treaty. And then George Bush famously unsigned the document in 2001. But really the source of the contention there was that split between developing and developed economies and who would have to reduce emissions and things like that.
Yeah, so the idea behind it, I guess you could say, was noble, because what people said was, well, look, you've had all of these years of, you know, putting out carbon dioxide to get your economies to where they are. And so there are other countries that are trying to get to the kind of living standards that you have, so they shouldn't be, I don't know, punished, I guess. But the problem, of course, was that, you know, the concept of developed and developing is already problematic because, you know, for example, China's manufacturing capacity is way above anything else in the world. So that aspect of the economy is quite developed. Their living standards, if you take the entire country, probably aren't as high as some other places in the world. So it's not this black and white thing, but they tried to put a, like Jeff said, a black and white box around it and said, well, these are developed and these aren't developing. And then the US said, well, that's not really fair. And lots of countries actually said that.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where, yeah, it was trying to do something good, but it misunderstood the nuance of the world, I think, somehow. And that's where it failed, I think, mainly.
Yeah, definitely. I'd just like to add that it's sort of a really interesting aspect of the negotiations that have kind of evolved over the last 21 meetings. So I think, you know, during Copenhagen, they tried to introduce the concept of common but differentiated responsibility, or CBDR. And this was basically the idea that every country would have obligations under a new agreement, but those who had sort of more historical emissions would bear a greater responsibility for reducing their current emissions. And that sort of evolved even further in the Paris negotiations into one of my favorite acronyms, actually, which is CBDRILONCWRC, which is common but different. It's a mouthful. Common but differentiated responsibilities in light of national circumstances with respective capabilities. So it's that's quite a mouthful, but yeah, it's definitely something that's been a contentious issue right through the process.
Yes, it sounds like as you said, it's difficult enough to get agreement within a country, let alone within those sorts of parameters. Difficult. You mentioned that Copenhagen was a failure. Was that also the same sort of thing as the Kyoto Protocol?
No, it was quite different, because Kyoto, the negotiations in Kyoto, I think you could call a success. Like they passed really what at the time was the first sort of global climate change protocol, and that was good. But Copenhagen was really a disaster, kind of from the outset. I think you kind of need to understand the mindset going into it. It was quite similar to Paris, I think, in some ways. Going into the actual negotiations, there was a lot of optimism. It really seemed like this was the moment that the world was going to come together and kind of pass this broad agreement. Barack Obama had just been sworn in earlier in the year, and there was a lot of optimism surrounding that. And then sort of the various countries got to Copenhagen, and it just was a disaster from the beginning, and nobody could agree on anything. And it really all completely fell apart. And basically what got done, if anything got done, was the Copenhagen, I don't know if it was an accord or what, but it was basically a statement that said climate change is bad and we should try to stop it. And that wasn't even adopted unanimously by the UN, so that was quite... It was really, there was a lot of disappointment and a lot of disillusionment after the process, but it was quite a different thing than Kyoto.
Yeah, so there's a slight differentiation. So the Kyoto Protocol is basically almost a solution. You know, this is what we're going to do, and this is how countries are going to report on their levels, and these are the credits that you're going to get. So countries were dealt, you know, carbon credits and all sorts of stuff after the Kyoto, or in line with the Kyoto Protocol, whereas Copenhagen, it was still just a meeting. So Kyoto Protocol was what came out of that meeting, COP3, and that was kind of the framework under which you would, you know, go on and do some stuff to reduce emissions. Whereas COP, was it 15?
Yeah.
Copenhagen was just, you know, it was a failed meeting, basically.
I guess there's a small, like, silver lining to COP15 was that although the meetings completely fell apart, it sort of sparked this... anger and action from a grassroots level. I think everyone kind of acknowledged at this point that, you know, maybe we can't just leave it to our governments to come up with all the answers. We have to, you know, try harder ourselves to put pressure on them. And from this, a lot of youth climate movements were initiated.
Yeah, that's definitely true. So kind of the founding, seeds for Generation Zero were from COP15 in Copenhagen. And not just us, but a lot of groups around the world, they were just like, yeah, we can't leave it to these people. They're not doing it right.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if you felt the same way, Hamish, but I think at COP21, sort of being on the ground in the civil society kind of NGO sector, it definitely felt like people were feeling pressure still from COP15, from it falling apart. There seemed to be people were carrying that weight around with them, you know, 6 years later, I thought. And then when the Paris Agreement was actually signed and people were out celebrating, it felt like a release of that kind of 6 years of pressure. Yeah, that's what it felt like to me on the ground.
Absolutely. I mean, the atmosphere was sort of torn between this this level of anxiousness about, you know, could we witness a repeat of COP15? And then there was this sort of, you know, torn between the anxiousness and this optimism that, you know, perhaps this could actually be the year. But definitely there was an increased level of urgency and this sort of nervousness that we could repeat what happened before.
Yeah. What I was going to add earlier, there's, for people that are interested in COP15 and Copenhagen and the COP process, there's a really great documentary called The Island President about the former president of the Maldives. And really, the Maldives is one of the nations on Earth that will be most affected by rising sea levels. And the second half of that documentary basically follows the president as he goes to COP15. And you can really see kind of behind the scenes a lot of what happened at the meeting. And it's, you know, it is a bit kind of in the weeds, but it's really interesting and a really good, I think, portrayal of the optimism going in and then kind of how it all fell apart throughout the negotiations.
That might be worth checking out then. Now we're just going to have our next break and we've got Pubudu, your song.
Cool. So it's called What's Going On. It was originally by Marvin Gaye. It's basically kind of a protest song, but it's about having a conversation with the other side and saying, let's talk before we judge. And it's actually by the Playing for Change Foundation, which is a really great charity organization that goes and does lots of cool stuff around the world. You guys should check them out.
Cool. And it sounds like that discussion must have been pretty critical, trying to put these agreements into place as well. You're with your hosts, Sally, Pubudu, Jeff, and Hamish, and we're talking COP and climate change. And in this section, we're going to specifically focus on Paris, COP21, which took place last year. Both Jeff and Hamish were actually involved in the process, which is pretty cool, guys. And I guess the first question is, why did you think that Paris was successful versus these stories of disappointment we've been hearing?
Well, I mean, the most obvious thing is we got an agreement out of Paris. There was a lot of, going into it, there were a lot of indications that the big players sort of were willing to come to the table in Paris in the summer, or, well, the North American summer leading up to COP21. I think a lot of it was the timing was kind of right. Like I said, the big players were sort of on board. In the U.S., I mean, one of the things that happened in Copenhagen from the U.S. perspective was that Obama had just been inaugurated that year, and he was using all his political capital to try and pass healthcare reform at the time, and he just didn't have much of a leg to stand on to try and do something else quite broad. And that concern was washed away in Paris, so the U.S. was in a better position to sort of come to the table. And I think it's similar stories in a lot of the other countries. But Hamish was in the negotiations with them, so I'd be interested to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it was a success, but I wouldn't say it was, you know, an amazing success. You know, I think the feeling there was that it was a step in the right direction, but probably no more than that. And I think the general feeling among the youth I was with that it was that it was more than we expected, but basically less than we hoped for. So, yeah, I think from an environmental sort of group perspective, they probably wanted more out of the agreements. There's, for example, there's some weak language around the long-term goal of 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees. But from perhaps from a governmental perspective, it was a success because for one instance, they were happy to sign a non-legally binding agreement. And things like, which probably contributed to the fact that it was signed in the first place. You know, the only reason the US could really sign this agreement was the fact that it was non-binding. But, you know, other things such as compliance mechanisms will be non-punitive, so there's no penalties for not complying with what's said in the agreement. So yeah, I think, you know, you can view the agreement two ways. It was successful in the sense that we got this agreement, but there's definitely a lot to be worked on.
Yeah, so I think like Hamish said, it's a diplomatic success. It's not a success in that if you look at the science and what we need to do, and if we want to say, well, here's what reality is going to do to humanity and the world, and here's where we need to be. It's just one step, and all of the details and all the messy stuff is still to be worked out. And I think that's where kind of the disappointment is. But at the same time, you know, given the hangover from Copenhagen, I mean, I remember being in the ground here in Christchurch, and we were all kind of listening in, and everyone was just like, oh, you know, yay. Phew, like it didn't just, yeah. There was no big fire. So I think it's this weird thing, right, where there's reality somewhere in the distance, and we're going, well, actually, given how terrible it was good. And it's always a comparison. It's not actually, yeah. So that's where the...
Yeah, I think it was Bill McKibben, who's the founder of 350.org, that said, basically, in terms of what could have happened, it was a miracle. In terms of what we needed to happen, it's a disaster. But that's kind of the place that we're at. I think looking at it as a diplomatic success is a good way to do it. And the other thing that I think is a reason to be optimistic is it's moving much quicker than Kyoto did. Kyoto didn't actually come into force until 2005, and it was negotiated in 1997. The Paris Agreement is moving along much, much quicker than that. It's still nowhere near where we need it to be, but I think there's at least a little bit more reason than we've had in the past to be optimistic about it.
And I think to that point, and to what Jeff said earlier as well, where big players are coming to the party. So before Paris, for example, China and the US had met and said, look, we need to work on this problem. It's going to be global. It's a massive issue. So there is, apart from the actual UNFCCC and these frameworks, there are other countries coming together kind of bilaterally almost saying, we need to work on this problem. And I think that's where some of the real hope is, for me at least. Not just that, you know, we have this agreement, but people are talking, because before, countries wouldn't really talk to each other about this so much, they would just go to COP and go, what do we do? Nothing. But now they're actually saying, well, okay, there's an issue, we need to deal with it. So I think that's the, yeah.
You said that the Paris Agreement's moving along. What sort of things have happened between last year and where we are now about to have COP22?
So a lot, it's been ratified by a number, I don't know the exact number, but it's a lot of countries. It's enough that it's going to be coming into force soon, the agreement. And there's been a number of other agreements that have sort of happened as well in between. Like most recently, last week in Rwanda, there was a large multilateral agreement on reducing hydrofluorocarbons, which are a greenhouse gas much worse than CO2, and that's really a quite significant agreement. And that doesn't, you know, necessarily have anything to do legally with the Paris Agreement, but it, as sort of the broad context, like the Paris Agreement definitely sets the context for those kind of things to happen. There's been a number of things, and as you were saying, the sort of the big players have increasingly shown that they're willing to negotiate bilaterally on these kind of issues.
Yeah, so the Paris Agreement will be coming into force basically in November, early November, because more than 55 countries accounting for more than 55% of global emissions have ratified it. That was the trigger condition for the agreement. So that's a great thing, and that happened in, you know, less than a year, and it's unprecedented, really, that countries would do something like that. And that's there's a lot of hope because of that.
Will it become legally binding once they've ratified it?
Not quite.
Yeah, this gets really, really complicated with how all this stuff actually works. To some extent, it depends on your philosophical view on international law, generally. I mean, what does legally binding internationally actually mean when you have sovereign? I mean, this is one of the big criticisms of the United Nations as a whole. So it depends on where you're looking and kind of what you think.
I think another important sort of thing that's happened since the Paris Agreement was that from the agreement there was a bit of an elephant in the room, and that was that emissions from aviation and maritime were not mentioned at all in the Paris Agreement. And so together those two industries represent sort of nearly 5% of global emissions. And if you group, you know, if you take that grouping as a country, I think that represents the fourth or fifth largest emitter in the world of emissions. So what's just happened recently is that the aviation industry have come together and actually formed a plan to reduce their emissions, which is quite positive. And I think the International Maritime Organization is meeting in October to discuss a similar thing. So it's really positive that there's some movement on that side, because no one really knew how they got away with it at Paris.
Is there much they can do other than having fewer flights?
There's certain things like shifting fuel away from fossil fuels to biofuels, having stricter standards for efficiency of planes. I think there's definitely things that they can work on.
Well, that's good to know. And how are environmental groups responding to the Paris Agreement? Has it been a generally positive view? I mean, we were talking about that kind of sense of few rather than yay. But yeah. Is there a sense that it might lead somewhere?
Yeah, I mean, I think the response has been kind of mixed. Different environmental groups have different takes on it. At the kind of, not that she's an environmental group herself, but kind of at the extreme, and there's people like Naomi Klein that say this is nowhere near good enough, and, you know, we have serious issues and we need to overthrow capitalism. And then there's more sort of muted responses that said, as we were saying, it's a good first step, and now we'll kind of see where we go from here. So it's been sort of a mixed bag, I think.
I think the main thing for it is after it's become ratified is that, you know, on the ground for the grassroots organizations within a certain country, it gives them something. Because what we can say now is, look, the government of the country, you've agreed to this level. You've said we want to keep temperature rise to well below 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees or whatever. Okay, well, that means you have to do something about it. And here's what we propose you should do. So it gives you a bit of, backing because the government has, you know, agreed to this thing. Whether it's legally binding or not, at least at a kind of marketing level, they've committed to this, right? So then that gives power to the groups on the ground to say, no, look, we're going to hold you to account now. The problem, of course, is globally, are there enough groups doing this to actually hold governments to account? And the answer to that, I would say, is not quite. But yeah, so I think that's the main power of the agreement at a local level. And of course, you know, different political parties can make it an election issue. They can say, look, the government of this country isn't doing enough, and when we come into power, we're going to completely change it all, and it's going to be great. But it also shows, I think, the populations of countries, look, there is a real problem. Your leaders, in inverted commas, agree. And so hopefully that's something.
Yeah, I guess, you know, in terms of, from the environmental group perspective, the biggest issue seems to be the sort of ambition gap between what the countries say they're going to do and what is actually needed. So I think, you know, even if we follow all of the current INDCs or intended national determined contributions, we're going to, you know, we're going to get to a temperature of around 2.7 degrees temperature rise. And I mean, really, we need to get below 2 and hopefully to 1.5. So there's that gap that currently sits there that no one really knows what to do, and that we obviously need to address.
Yeah, and just to point out, this is kind of vital. So to get to 2 degrees, if we emit at the current levels, we have till 2035 to stop everything. For 1.5 degrees, we have 5 years. So at the current level, so not increasing, if we keep everything flat, we have to stop all greenhouse gas emissions in about 5 years if we want to keep temperature rise to 1.5 degrees.
It's scary,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, 1.5 is tough. I mean, this is my personal opinion. I think 1.5 is a kind of a ridiculous target to talk about. Like, it's not going to happen without some sort of really amazing technological wizardry, which isn't to say that couldn't happen. But it's definitely an aspirational target, but it's not a realistic one. But I just wanted to go back to the point you were making earlier, because I think it's a really good one. This agreement really, it does give environmental groups something to hang their hat on, basically. In Naomi Klein's This Changes Everything documentary, there's some really great footage of Barack Obama talking about opening the largest amount of land to oil exploration of any president and all these kind of things. And really, for the first time now, this agreement allows environmental groups to go and say, look, what you're saying here does not align with what you have signed us up for. And I think we shouldn't underestimate how important that is.
Yeah. Okay, well, that sounds like a perfect place to pick up in our final segment. Jeff, we've got your song for our break.
Yeah, I can't say there's a really specific reason that I picked it. I'm a bit of a music buff, so I get like, I kind of have like mini existential crises when I have to pick a song for these kind of things. But this one I was listening to it a lot recently. It felt right. There's a nice line about the snow in it, and it just seemed to fit. So that's it.
Okay, so here we go. Feel It All by KT Dunstall.
I'm growing like a seed. Rain's been falling on me. I've been covered in cold. I've been shrouded.
To speak up, Cordero-tia. We're with Pubudu, Jeff and Hamish talking about COP and is it an effective means of combating climate change? And so far I'm getting the sense that it's a mixed sensation, some positives, some negatives. And just in this final segment, we're going to build on this discussion, thinking about where are we going from here. We're about to have the COP22, which is in Marrakesh, and is that likely to build on the success, and I say that in inverted commas with a little bit of humour, the success of Paris, or do we think it's likely just to be another talking fest without much actual practicalities arising from it?
I think you never really know. I think it'll probably do quite a good job of getting into the weeds on the implementation of the Paris Agreement. After Kyoto, that was done at COP7 in 2001, so 4 years after. So we're moving at a much quicker pace, like we were saying before. And I think probably what's likely to come out of it is some implementation procedures for the actual agreement. But as we were saying, as Hamish was saying in particular, there is a big ambition gap there. So all the implementation procedures in the world won't necessarily get us to where we need to go if they don't bridge the gap.
Yeah, I think it's also important to remember that the Paris Agreement will only come into force, the agreement sort of starts in 2020. So the fact that they've ratified it already means that we sort of have 4 years to prepare ourselves and to sort of iron out the rule book, so to speak, for how to report and account for climate action in the future. So I think that's really where Marrakesh sits. It's the starting point to sort of start this rule book as it is.
Yeah, and I think the countries are going there with a mandate because of the agreement, and I think that's the main positive thing. I mean, in Copenhagen, for example, you know, they just kind of turned up, right? There was nothing leading up to it, whereas there's a lot of, one, hopefully societal pressure, and two, the countries themselves, the people themselves have been involved in this process, and they're probably quite happy about what happened in Paris, the diplomats, I mean. So I think there's that mandate, which is helpful.
One question I guess I was thinking about is various countries have ratified it in this year between Paris and Marrakesh. Is it possible, and I'm thinking particularly of the US elections, if we were to get, well, there's a new president coming up.
Yeah.
Is it possible for the president or a new leader of any country to reverse that decision, unsign, as we mentioned before?
Yeah. So in the US, that's a very real possibility. So the US is always very unique in these kind of things because for most countries, sort of the head of government can show up and say, we're going to do this, and then go back and basically do it. And in the US, you can't, that doesn't really happen. So what can happen is what did happen with Paris. The Obama administration said, we're going to sign it. They signed it. And then basically, President Obama used his power of what's called an executive agreement to make basically to ratify it as an executive agreement instead of a treaty. Because a treaty has to go to the Senate and be voted on to become like enshrined in U.S. legislation. So the next president can theoretically just wipe away executive agreements. They're not sort of legally binding in that sense. So that's a real possibility. I mean, if Hillary Clinton wins, that will not happen. If Donald Trump wins, that probably will happen, that he'll get rid of the executive agreement. The other thing that's quite significant with the U.S. in terms of implementing the agreement is that the way that it's going to be done is under something called the Clean Power Plan, which is a big Obama administration kind of it's a big sort of legacy item for him. And the Clean Power Plan allows the EPA, which is the Environmental Protection Agency, to limit and basically regulate greenhouse gas emissions in the power sector. And the Supreme Court earlier this year basically said you can't enforce this until it goes through a legal process because number of states, I think, I don't know the number, more than half, I think, the states are suing the federal government saying you can't do this. And it was really unprecedented for the Supreme Court to sort of take that power plan off the books until the legal process plays out. So it's just been heard at the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the second highest court in the United States, and it will probably go to the Supreme Court where it will be decided. And if the Supreme Court strikes it down, then that's a major blow to the United States' ability to implement the Paris Agreement. So yes, in that context, there's a variety of things that could go wrong in the U.S. The Supreme Court is sort of toss a coin, like we don't really know what would happen. But a lot depends on the election there because there's a Supreme Court justice missing right now. And if Donald Trump wins, it'll be a conservative. If Hillary Clinton wins, it'll be a liberal. And then that will have a big impact on how the case is decided. But it's not always as complex in different places.
Yeah, so in New Zealand, I mean, there's obviously potential for it to get reversed. But the thing is, like I was saying in the break, you know, New Zealand, the government of New Zealand at the moment has probably been reluctant to act on climate change issues, I would say, but they ratified it. So it's unlikely that a change of government would lead to a reversal, just from a kind of political perspective. Other countries, I mean, a place like China, I would say, given the system of government, it's very unlikely that they would reverse it unless they decided to. So, yeah, it really, like Jeff said, depends on the individual countries.
Oh,
sorry, Hamish.
I guess just to add a sort of UK perspective, things were people were sort of wondering what was going to happen for a while, because with the UK leaving Europe, there was sort of of course the Paris Agreement was signed by UK under the EU sort of group, so it was unclear about whether or not the UK would remain part of that signature, but basically the result is that the UK will remain a party to the agreement, so there won't be any change here.
That's good to hear. Seeing as you touched on New Zealand, Pibudu, how's New Zealand's record in this space?
Well, it's not great, to be honest. So New Zealand, under the Kyoto Protocol, for example, claims that we're doing enough and that we actually got some credits. But the problem is, one of the major problems is that we got a lot of credits that were from Eastern Bloc countries when the Soviet Union fell, and
carbon credits.
Carbon credits. Yeah.
What is a carbon credit, maybe?
It's basically, like, in really simple terms, it's basically a credit you can purchase from somebody so you can continue to emit.
Emit greenhouse gases because you got savings in the bank, basically.
Yeah.
But anyway, the credits that New Zealand got probably weren't really legitimate, just because there were some dodgy dealings going on, not from New Zealand itself, but the people selling them. And because of that, we would say that, you know, our claims of reducing emissions aren't actually true. And if we kind of look at the projections and track real emissions, so forget about credits, but real emissions, they've just continued to go up, which is a problem for New Zealand. And so we have this gap between where we want to be and where we'll end up being. And by 2030, that'll be even bigger if we don't do something. The problem is the government is saying, well, look, under the Kyoto Protocol, we're fine. We're going to be okay till 2020, and then we can think about what to do then. We don't think it's good enough because we don't think those credits are really legitimate.
Well, also with you saying in 5 years' time it will be too late for that 1.5 degrees, that's the 2020, it's already there.
Exactly. And I think the biggest problem is governments don't really reflect what the science says. That's the thing. So scientists can yell till they're blue in the face saying, look, this is the limit. But the government will say, well, no, but we have experts who, you know, economic experts or whatever, the other experts who are not climate scientists, who will say we had to think of other problems as well. And I think that's where some, I guess, more kind of extreme people would say, well, capitalism is a problem rather than climate change. And it's because when we say, you know, we have this overarching system that we have to take care of, and we have to, you know, have, like, economic concerns become a major factor of this, rather than say what we can produce in technological terms, then governments are unwilling to say, well, we're going to do something that'll take a massive economic impact. For example, in New Zealand, agriculture is a big problem because it's our biggest emitter. But if you say, well, we need to do something about that, that's not a good economic thing for New Zealand at the moment, and so governments aren't willing to actually address that point.
Yeah, I think one thing also that's worth remembering in the New Zealand case that is quite interesting is that New Zealand occupies kind of a unique space globally in terms of emissions, in that when you consider all of the countries of the world, its emissions are really quite low. But when you consider where it stands in the broader Pacific, they're extremely high. And so there's an interesting dichotomy going on there that makes what New Zealand does politically kind of interesting.
Yeah, and also New Zealand does have very high per capita emissions. So the number of people, if you divide the amount of emissions by the number of people, our emissions are high, and that's kind of the slight embarrassment and elephant in the room for New Zealand when we go to negotiate. We say, oh, we're doing enough, but people are like, really?
Yeah, I think especially with its clean green image.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to add quickly, I think one of the key things that sort of the government seems to say is that, you know, any sort of meaningful action is very expensive.
Mm.
And I think that's it comes across as a bit weak when we consider that, you know, the cost of inaction is probably going to be more expensive, but, you know, for the next generation rather than the current one.
Yeah, which brings me back to the point of this being a pretty young panel.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think just quickly to add to that, there was a report from the UK called the Stern Report, which basically tried to measure how much of an impact climate change would have if we didn't do anything, or at different levels of temperature rise. And basically, at above 2 degrees, something like between 5 to 10% reduction in global GDP. And that's, you know, I mean, you talk about growth rates of 3% over 10 years in GDP, and if you suddenly lose 5 to 10% of global GDP, then that's a big hit. But that doesn't really register, because it is not a problem right now.
Yeah. Mm. I think that's part of the problem with climate change, isn't it? It's such a gradual thing that it's somebody else's issue almost.
Well, it's like the frog in the boiling water thing, right?
Yeah, yes. Exactly. And it's just such an abstract concept, sort of generally. You can't see it or touch it or really engage with it on that level, and that makes it quite difficult, I think.
I think just quickly for that, and that's where the Montreal Protocol for the CFCs was really successful, because...
Hydrofluorocarbons.
Yeah.
That was successful because it was literally damaging the ozone layer, and you could see in satellite pictures a hole in the ozone. And you're like, that's getting bigger, that's scary. So that's a tangible thing, even though it's up high in the atmosphere.
Yeah. So. And that was probably one of the most successful environmental treaties globally ever signed. Real success story.
Definitely. And the chlorofluorocarbons.
That's right. CFC. Okay, well, just to wrap it up then. We've been talking about COP and is it an effective means of combating climate change. Just in a single sentence, yes or no?
In a single sentence, yes, provisionally.
I would say yes, provisionally as well.
Okay, and Hamish?
Oh, yeah, obviously. I guess it provides a rallying point for NGOs and civil society to put pressure on the government to make change, sort of regardless of the outcome of the actual negotiations.
Perfect. Okay, well, I'd like to thank you very much for taking the time to be part of this. I think it's been a really informative discussion, and fingers crossed, hey, for Marrakesh and see what happens there.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for having
us. Yeah, thank you.
And to our listeners out there, check out the Facebook page. We now have Twitter, and also there'll be a transcript online.